Hello, this is Mike Jarrett. Is this Dr. Porter?
It is, Mike. How are you?
Good. You've got a few minutes to talk to me about this project of mine?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Tell me how you started producing, and perhaps more specifically, how did you end up at Prestige?
I had been corresponding with Don Schlitten and Bob Weinstock. Actually, I started out corresponding with Esmond Edwards. This is the early 60s. We're talking now 62, 63, 64. 63 to 66, I'm in the Army. And I wrote letters, manic letters, to those guys all the time. And Weinstock used to tell me, he says, look, when you get out of the Army, call me up and maybe I'll have something for you. Well, I call him up when I get out. He didn't have anything for me. But I stayed in touch with everybody, kept writing liner notes for them and alerting them to anything. I was out in L.A. at the time, alerting them to anything that was happening with their stuff on the radio in L.A. Because L.A. had two all-jazz radio stations at the time. So, as I say, staying in touch, when Schlitten came out to record Sonny Criss, I picked him up, I went to the session with him, et cetera, et cetera. And we became pretty tight. And at a time when he became officially the Prestige recording director after the departure of Cal Lampley, he hired me to work the soul jazz roster. And that I started in 1968.
And were you lobbying other record labels, or was Prestige your label of choice?
Well, I had a job at the time. My wife and I were living in California, and you know, it's California, Southern California lifestyle, very seductive. I wouldn't have left there for anything else. I mean, I stayed in touch with Pacific Jazz because I had worked as a gopher for Dick Bach before I hooked up with Prestige.
I see.
So, you know, I tried to stay in touch with as many people as possible. Esmond had left Prestige and was at Chess at that time, recording people for the Argo label. So, you know, when somebody leaves and goes to another job, that's one more contact that I have, you know.
Right. Now, when you arrived there, did you already know how to produce a record, or did you learn on the job?
I had been to a few recording sessions. In 63, Dick Bach started to, he had Groove Holmes under contract, and they had, after a very good start with Groove, his first couple of LPs, the third and fourth ones, just went nowhere. So he asked me to talk to Groove and see if we could come up with a project. So I did talk with Groove and, you know, see what could get done. But by the time I got back to Groove Holmes, I was at Prestige in 1968. But in 63, Bach signed an organist from Kansas City named Charles Kennard. And he asked me to come out because, you know, Dick's thing wasn't really organ records. His thing was West Coast jazz. But he had to have some of that on his roster because that's what the people wanted to hear at that time. So I helped him out on a date with Sonny Stitt, and which Charles Kennard played on. And then I actually was at some of the sessions that made up Kennard's album with Clifford Scott and Ray Crawford and those guys. So, I mean, 63 was the year that I learned. I learned everything I could learn about that, but I didn't get a chance to apply it until 68.
I see. Okay. Well, let's take a recording that is much admired, Charles Erwin's Black Talk, and tell me what your contributions were to that recording, and then maybe as a follow-up to that, how that recording perhaps exemplifies your notion of what a producer should do and what production should be.
Well, you want me to set it up a little, tell you how Charlie came to the label?
I'd love for you to, sure.
Okay. As I said before, I had been hired to work the soul jazz roster at Prestige. Schlitten wasn't interested in it. He had his own artists, Jackie Byard, Booker Irvin, people like that. So I had signed Rusty Bryant, I had signed Billy Butler, and I had signed an organist named Sonny Phillips. But Groove Holmes had left. And oddly enough, he went back to Pacific Jazz. So we needed to find another good, solid organ player. I still had Johnny Hammondsmith on the roster, but, I mean, we needed a real, you know, powerhouse guy. So at one point, Charlie at that time was working with Lou Donaldson. And I had, at one point, Schlitten and I went to a benefit, and Lou played some of the stuff on a benefit, and Erland was in the group, and Schlitten mentioned to me he thought that Charlie would be a good organ player, that I should check him out. So I had become very tight with Houston Person at this time. I was recording him, and he lived in Newark. I lived in Bergenfield, and we would, you know, hang out a lot when he wasn't working. So we went down to the Key Club one night to hear the Lou Donaldson. At that time, it was a quartet. Lou had trumpet, organ, and drums as his background. He had no guitar in the working band, although they used guitar on his records. And Charlie Erlen just blew my head off. I had never heard anybody. I mean, he was in the Groove Holmes tradition of a real powerhouse kind of player. But he's even more so, I think, than Groove. And he just blew my head off. And I talked to him that day, and I said, let's do a deal. And he was up for it, and we did it. And we recorded him, I believe it was December 69 the first time. And essentially, let me say one thing about producing jazz records. There are a lot of different ways to do it. In my way, most of the work is done before the session. That is to say, you come up with a band, you come up with a concept. And basically the concept was Charlie was going to bring in a few tunes. And I suggested Houston Person, who he had known and worked with on some gigs. And Virgil Jones, who had worked with Houston on Johnny Hammond-Smith records, and would become like the house trumpet player at Prestige for many years, 2-3 years anyway. And then we used the band that he was recording with Lou, Melvin Sparks on guitar and Idris Muhammad on drums.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the way we put the band together. My contribution to Black Talk was two things. I asked for a short, fast blues for radio play, and that's where the Mighty Burner came from. Charlie came up with that on the date. The other stuff he came in with. And, of course, the big tune that he came in with was turned out to be More Today Than Yesterday, which ultimately was 11 minutes long. And at that time, my contribution to that particular track was say, look, let's have no horn solos. The horns have lines to play, but and Virgil has a muted thing on the intro, but... with horn solos, it may be too long. And as it turned out, I was right about that, because with just guitar and organ solos, it was 11 minutes long. One other thing is that More Today Than Yesterday, great as though we all knew it was, wasn't our first shot. We put out a single with Mighty Burner on one side, and the other side, it was an edited version of Black Talk. And the title track, Black Talk, is actually Eleanor Rigby.
Hmm.
And that came about because Charlie and Houston had worked a gig down on the Jersey Shore maybe a week or so before the record date, or maybe it was just the weekend before the record date. And they came back in and they were very, very positive about this and the way it had worked on the gig. So they, we did it on the record date and it sounded great. So... in reality, we had a single at the same time the album was happening, but the single wasn't what was getting played. What was getting played was the 11-minute version of the of More Today Than Yesterday.
Yeah.
And I should mention this, a guy named Sonny Hobson. Sonny Hobson was very tight with not only Charlie, but Charlie's manager. Charlie's manager was a guy named Leon Cannonball Fisher from Philadelphia. And Sonny Hobson broke that record wide open in Philadelphia. And from Philly, it spread to Chicago and L.A., Detroit. Those were our major markets, Philly, Chicago, Detroit, L.A. If we were selling records in any two of those markets, we could have a hit. Because the you could sell that many LPs in those markets in those years.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, that the San Francisco and Cleveland and Boston and New York didn't sell records, but not like those. Those were breakout markets. They had radio that sold records in those towns.
Yeah.
So that's how that got off the ground. That's how it, you know, that's how Black Sox happened. It really launched Charlie. Big, big hit record. I don't know what it sold. I left Prestige at the end of 71, and it was at about 120,000 then, and it was still selling. So my guess is that it probably ended up over 200,000 when all things were.
Yeah. Now, when it was recorded, I assume that you were already lined up for what, one day a week over at Rudy Van Gelder's?
Essentially that was it. Rudy had a lot of customers, Creed Taylor, Bob Thiel, you know, still some Blue Note work, although by that time Alfred was gone. And I shouldn't say that. Frank Wolf was still around, and they were doing Blue Note dates on a regular basis at Van Gelder. So there were at least, maybe Thiel had left Impulse by that time. But I know Blue Note and Creed were in there at the same time I was. I remember one time that I had a session scheduled with Gene Ammons, and the band gets stuck in New Orleans because of a snowstorm, and they couldn't get there. And I asked Rudy whether it'd be possible to switch dates with Creed. And that was a big deal at that time, a real federal case getting that thing done.
Yeah.
But we got it done. As I say, Rudy was... I didn't get in his way. I tried to stay out of his way because he had an ability to listen to that music and know what it should sound like on record. My goal was always to make records that sounded good on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they sounded good on the radio, you had a chance to really sell some records. And that was Rudy's whole thing. He was in agreement with me on that.
Yeah.
Make records that sounded good on the radio.
Now, even in 68, would you, let's say, if there was a little glitch in a take, would you call for another take, or would you, loathe as you were to do so, would you do some post-production with Van Gelder?
Well, at that time, remember in 68, I was still doing two-track.
Mm.
I mean, I started doing some multi-track stuff in... I guess it was probably late 69, early 70. But, I mean, the first Charlie Erland record was done in two-track. That was mixed as on the fly.
Yeah.
And that's one of Rudy Van Gelder's real geniuses, man. He had that all figured out.
Yeah.
And certain records you didn't have to mix at all.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when you get into more, orchestral stuff, like with the Gene Ammons records with the strings and the horns and everything, that's when... multi-track recording, you need it.
Yeah. Now, did you fall into that? Let's talk about that then. Gene Ammons and the multi-track approach. When you did, would you do true multi-tracking, or would everybody be in the room and you would isolate and work? You know, how would you work there?
It was 8-track in those days.
Okay.
I mean, 8-track and 16-track came together very quickly. I don't recall whether I believe we started 8-track, but I know we were doing 16 by the last sessions I was doing in 71. And by 71, virtually everything was being done multi-track.
Yeah.
Because to a certain extent, you didn't know. At that time, we were selling a lot of records. And when you're selling a lot of records, you don't want to go out into the marketplace with something that could be better. If you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I had a project with Johnny Hammondsmith, the last record date on the that he did for us on the label. It's called What's Going On. This was 1971. And Johnny had, I believe he had already signed with CTI when he recorded the album. But his first CTI album took off like a rocket. And, you know, I, by that time, Fantasy had taken over. Fantasy had owned the label. And they said, look, why don't you take what you've got on Johnny Hammond Smith and put some stuff on it and just as insurance?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea was that Creed stuff was so idiosyncratic, if you will, that we're not trying to sound like him, but we're not trying to sound like old-fashioned. So I brought in Bill Fisher. We did some horns. We scrubbed a guitar track and put Ted Dunbar on some tunes. And it was a much better sounding record once you get through with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I believe that I did the right thing then. And Johnny did, too, because we had a hit with that record.
Right, right. I guess in some ways what you're doing there is maybe not the full Creed Taylor thing, but something perhaps more closely aligned with what Atlantic would do.
Well, Joel was into multi-tracking, multi-track recording years before I was.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, he had resources in Atlantic that I didn't have at Prestige.
Yeah,
I mean, the Charlie Erland record, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. For studio costs, for musician costs, even mastering costs, $2,100.
My Lord.
I mean, it sounds wild, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's, you know, as I say. But oddly enough, back in those years, oftentimes you could spend that amount of money and still lose money because jazz records were not selling at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about the time I started buying them. so
well,
I was
a good time. You came in at the right time.
I came in at the right wrong time. Right, it was kind of hard to find a fellow hipster in the south part of the United in Chattanooga, Tennessee. But it was a good time. Music was good.
Yes.
You know, I may want to jump back at some of the stuff you did at Prestige, but in preparation to talk to you, I was listening to. That Illinois Jacquette record you did over at Atlantic, Jacquette's
yes.
Got It. Yeah, which I really enjoyed. I actually wrote about it a little bit a long time ago, and Jacquette actually sent me a postcard, a really nice postcard, thanking me for saying something about it. But that was a pretty big production. You've got a big band there, and
was a working band.
Okay, so you just brought in the working band.
In the early 80s, Illinois was a guest lecturer at Harvard University for 2 years. And he found that the kids were so responsive to what he was talking about and what he was teaching them that he said to himself, hey, I should form a band of professionals. And that's what he did for the last 20 years of his life. He led a big band.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, personnel would change from time to time, and they weren't on the road all the time. But the fact of the matter is that's how he appeared. You didn't hear him with quartets and organ trios around New York during that time. It was the big band.
Yeah.
And that came together for the simple reason that when I was working for Atlantic, I worked directly for Ahmet Erdogan. I didn't have to go through anybody else, which was absolutely great.
Yeah.
So periodically, knowing what he was, Ahmet was really like a Renaissance man when it came to American music. He was into everything. And especially if it was black music, he knew more about gospel and he knew more about blues piano players, you know, than anybody. He and Wexler together were just an unbeatable team. Now, by the time I got there, Wexler was gone and Ahmet's doing things on his own. And the label's hot as a firecracker with all this rock stuff. But Ahmet was one of these guys who wanted to record certain people regardless of whether or not the record sold. In some cases, he would record people and the records wouldn't even come out. He just wanted to record somebody and put some money in their pocket.
Wow.
That's an aspect of the business that existed at Atlantic and almost no other place that I have ever. but they were so hot. They, you know, if they spent $20,000 on a record at that time, with a, and actually the Jacquette record cost a lot more than $20,000. But,
yeah.
Because you got union rules. Although we did not pay any overtime for that record, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Well, the charts were already done and everything, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And of course, the band rehearsed like crazy.
Yeah.
So when they came in, I mean, it was rare that we had to do two takes on anything. It was just bim, bam, boom. We sat down and he got it done.
Yeah.
He was a very good band leader in the sense that he knew what he wanted, and he would be tough on those musicians until he got what he wanted. We brought in some ringers on that date. Duffy Jackson was not the regular drummer. But and Illinois decided that he would be the best drummer. I was thinking about Butch Miles, but Illinois decided on Duffy. He wanted to use Milt Hinton because he and Milt Hinton were neighbors out in Long Island. So we used Milt Hinton on bass, despite the fact that Mona insisted on double scale for Milt. We brought in Marshall Royal to lead the reed section. We brought in John Faddis to lead the trumpet section. But the other guys are all guys who actually worked with the band at the time.
Oh, wow.
Eddie Bearfield, Joey Cavasino, Rudy Rutherford, you know, Frank Lacy. Frank Lacy was like virtual unknown at the time, and he had a couple of great trombone solos on the record. And Irv Stokes was another trumpet solos. I mean, Faddis was great on that record, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, that's how that happened. But it happened because I said to Ahmet, hey, you want to record Illinois Jacquette? And initially, and all of a sudden he perked up and he said, yeah, because he had heard that band live.
Mm-hmm.
And that he knew what they were capable of, but he knew the history of that kind of music. So it was basically, it was his project from the get-go. I was just the guy who supervised the sessions.
Now, I don't think I'm working, I've putzed around on the internet and so on, and I don't know how good a discography I'm looking at of yours. Were there other artists that you inherited at Atlantic?
The only new dates I did at Atlantic was Illinois' album and a session done live at the Village Vanguard with Fathead Newman.
Uh-huh.
We brought in Hank Crawford and Stanley Turrentine to guest on that project.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Atlantic really wasn't recording a lot of jazz at the time. They tried John Snyder, and Snyder came in with some projects, and, you know, we did a deal for a Mel Lewis big band album, but, I mean, there really wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for jazz at Atlantic from anybody. Once Snyder was let go, there was nobody in that slot.
Yeah.
And Ahmet used to say between Porter and Ilhan Mimaroglu, you know, if we're going to do some jazz, we'll do it with those guys, which was okay with me. I mean, you know, I had plenty of work to do there in just doing all our reissues.
Yeah.
But I would bring it up, and of course, Ahmet was the one who he brought me in to do the Fathead record, because Fathead had a deal with Atlantic. And they needed somebody to do a project with him. I suggested Live Project, and, you know, we went for it that way.
Now, when you produce a drummer, and this is a drummer, that's part of my question. When you produce a recording, because of your real affinity for, you know, what Bob Weinstock would have called, you know, like a really funky sort of bluesy track, were you most concerned to start with that bottom, start with the drummer, or did you proceed differently?
When I first came to New York, I didn't know the best musicians to use for specific projects. I mean, it's one thing to hear guys on records, but it's another thing to know how they're going to do on a session of yours.
Yeah.
You know, so I was using a variety of different guys. I think it was Harold Mayburn who brought Idris to my attention, because at the time, Idris was still Leo Morris. And Mabe wanted to use him on Raking and Scraping. Oh, no, it wasn't on Raking and Scraping. It was on something else. And I said, you know, in those days, if musicians had strong feelings about somebody, I usually went with it, unless there was something that, you know, said not to do it. And Idris worked great with Mayburn, and from that point we got him into, you know, Charlie Erland, we got him into, you know, a bunch of other guys. And that little group with Sparks and first Charlie and later Leon Spencer, those who work with Lou after Charlie, those guys became like a rhythm section for us. They did 7 or 8 records together. And they always sounded good.
Yeah.
Idris, you know, his funny story about him. When he came to New York, he wanted to play modern jazz. But when they found out that he was from New Orleans, when the musicians found out that he was from New Orleans, they wanted to hear his New Orleans street beat. That's the beat that attracted Lou Donaldson to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of beat that he used on all those hit records that he made back in those years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how did you meet Pretty Purdy?
Johnny Hammondsmith.
Uh-huh.
Johnny wanted to use him on a date call, and we did it called Black Talk. And the Black Talk thing had actually 2 different drum features for Purdy, which is unusual on an organ record. But I just found Purdy to be the most energetic guy I've ever run across on a recording date. He was into everything, man. He had this little sign. He would bring in a music stand, put his little sign up there, and the sign said, "Pretty Purdy, the little old hitmaker, done it again." It's actually, if you know the very first Purdy record on Prestige, that sign is on the cover.
Is that right? I'll have to look at one of the catalogs I have. Yeah, yeah, I'll look it up.
But I'm still in touch with Purdy. We talk to each other all the time. He's still, you know, he lives in Jersey, and he's, you know, he's not all that active. He's older than I am, I think.
Uh-huh.
He's still out there playing, and, you know, he loves to play.
Yeah. He was.
When they had that revival of Hair on Broadway, Purdy played that show.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. He was an integral part of that show.
Yeah. Well, he was unbelievably active. I know I was at some blog site not long ago, and someone had put together a compilation of his stuff. And I was astonished at just these big soul hits, for example, that he was the anchor of. Yeah.
Well, that Atlantic House rhythm section with Richard T. and Eric Gale and Purdy and who the hell was the other guy, the bass player? Either Jerry Jamont or Chuck Rainey. You know, they made most of Joel's records and a lot of the records for other producers in Atlantic, too.
Right, right. Yeah, that explains him being on, for example, a Dusty Springfield recording or something. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I think my targeted reader does not understand, and that is what a producer's job is and role is in doing reissues. You've done so many, but there again, I don't think people understand the amount of work and what kind of work goes into doing that. Could you pick a project that would be nicely illustrative of what you have done with so many reissues?
Well, there are several different kinds of reissues. In some cases, you simply reissue an album as it was originally issued. That's the easiest thing. All you got to do is new cover, new liner notes, boom, go. When I worked at Savoy, I had done reissues at Prestige prior to that, or a few things, and I'd done a couple of reissues for Esmond. When he was at Chess, I did one on Sonny Stitt, one on Ahmad Jamal. But I really got into it when I went to Savoy in 1975. And Steve Backer, the late Steve Backer, was the guy who hired me for that job. And I was rather astonished at the amount of stuff that Savoy had. They had acquired a lot of different labels. And as I say, like some of them, for example, you just put out the record as it was originally issued. new notes, new cover, something like that. But one of the problems she had with Savoy was that people didn't like Herman Lubinsky. And you found a lot of artists, especially in the 40s, when Teddy Reig was there, who would do one session, four tunes. And, you know, you don't have enough for an album. So you've got to come up with concepts where you can combine, you know, a bunch of different artists who had small, relatively small number of sides for Savoy and put them into a project. Now, with Savoy, the concept was double albums, which was okay with me because we had a lot of artists that fit that. But on some of the guys who didn't make a lot of sides for Savoy, I had to come up with something that, you know, would enable us to get that stuff out. So I came up with concepts like the Brothers and Other Mothers, essentially the white tenor players of the 40s, Getz, Al Cohn, you know, people like that, Alan Eager, Drew Moore. Another one was the Changing Face of Harlem. Savoy was always into black jazz rather than bebop. They were into it early. And they recorded a lot of guys, you know, so we took a lot of those sides. We took Pete Brown. We took some of the Tony Grimes stuff, some of the Lips Page things, where you didn't have enough for an album. And we combined them in this concept album called The Changing Face of Harlem. The essential idea here was to show just through, you know, moving from side A, number one, to side D, number eight, you know, how the music may have changed over a couple of three-year period. We did two double albums of The Changing Face of Harlem. Probably could have done a third one without much trouble because there was some stuff on Savoy that we didn't get to. I'd say we probably got to about 95% of it. But I would have still liked to have done an album on Leo Parker, an album on Alan Eager, and an album on Pete Brown.
Yeah.
Those were the only three that I feel we didn't get to. And all the Eager stuff came out in the Brothers and Other Mothers. Most of Leo came out one way or another, and most of Pete came out, but not all of it, and not individually. But between the Brothers and Other Mothers and the Changing Face of Harlem and Black California, for example, I mean, those were projects that we had to do because of the lack of enough stuff to do one album by any individual.
Yeah. That explains a lot.
It's the kind of thing you have to know the music. You have to know what artists were compatible with one another. You have to know how much stuff you've got. You've got to know how you're going to fit it and sequence it. The final volume of California stuff was called Cool California, and that was the white guys.
Mm-hmm.
It was Shelly Mann. It was Cal Jader. It was the Johnny Richards Orchestra with Dizzy. And I think there was Georgie Ault, the Georgie Ault Band, which was actually recorded in New York, I think. But the idea was that they had enough California players on it, so, you know, Jimmy Rolls or Neil Hefti or people like that, you know, so that you could make it work in terms of its concept.
Yeah.
So that's what you try and do. I mean, hopefully in those anthologies, you're going to get writers talking about it because it'll give them something to say. You know, if you just put out an album of Herbie Mann and just issue it the way it was regularly released, you know, you're not going to get anybody talking about that. It's not news. Even a great record like the Milt Jackson record with Opus to Bop on it, I mean, that, you know, which was a hit when it was originally issued. When we reissued it, you know, nobody cared. When it first came out, the idea of flute and vibes was an interesting concept. It wasn't done very well or done very often. But by the time we get to it in the mid-70s, it's routine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the big projects, the Charlie Parkers, the Lester Youngs, we were fortunate and we had enough stuff to do it. It took me a long time to do the Charlie Parker box because I could not locate original source material on everything.
Now you're talking about the Savoy right there.
Yeah,
right. Yeah,
that's the one. I won a Grammy for that.
Yeah.
And the reason that that took so long was that I finally found the session, the one session I didn't have on acetate disc, was the Detroit session from December, which had Bluebird on it, and I can't remember the other tunes, but I finally found them. And the way I found them was they weren't on 16-inch acetate discs, mm-hmm. which is the way disc sessions were customarily recorded. They were on 10-inch blanks, mm. with one tune only on each, you know, on each side.
Yeah.
So that, we finally got it all together, and the box set sound was better than the original master takes. The master takes were taken from tape, which had been dubbed in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, mm-hmm. we were able to get much better sound in the box set.
Yeah. And did Lubinsky really record all those, or did he have other people?
Lubinsky wasn't a music guy. Lubinsky was a business guy.
Yeah.
Lubinsky gets into the music from a store called United Radio, which sold radio and parts and things like electronic parts and things like that.
Yeah.
He got into the record business as a retailer because, you know, the black audience that he had for his job bought records. So they put in a record section in United Radio, and that's how he started to learn who and what to record. And he got into it in 1942, just before the ban, I guess. And once the ban was over, he, you know, in late 44, he picked up and went wild. The next 5 years or so were just really wonderful years for Savoy Jazz.
Yeah.
And much of that stuff was done by Teddy Reed. Teddy starts in 1945, and he's the guy who did most of the key important jazz recordings
yeah.
during that time. He wasn't the only one. Gil Fuller did some. I know that Bobby Shadd did some, but I'm not sure which ones he did. And then, of course, at that time, they were acquiring stuff from other labels, and, you know, like that. But Teddy Reed was the first guy, first main guy, as I
right.
say, not the only guy. Lee Magid really replaced Teddy after a while. I'm trying to think. Ozzie Cadena comes in 54. Ozzie's mm-hmm. first date is the K. Winding J.J. Johnson 10-inch LP that's done in 54. And he was there for about 6 years. Ozzie's the guy who really did most of the LP-era jazz.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Once again, he wasn't the only guy, but he did most of it.
Yeah.
So Teddy Reed in the 40s, Ozzie Cadena in the 50s, Lee Magid in between the two of them. Those were really the guys. Freddie Mendelson did some jazz recording, mostly avant-garde jazz, in the 60s, but it was poorly recorded, and it wasn't very good.
Right. But it was amazing that it showed up on that label to me. It seemed like such an anomaly in some way. So I guess it was Mendelssohn's behest or something that it was.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as I, you know, clearly it wasn't costing a lot of money to record one of those things, and the jazz critics, that's all I could talk about in those years.
Right. Yeah. Does it, you know, I don't know whether this is a completely fair question, but does it myth you to some extent that the critics have always been inclined, let's say, to maybe a sort of modernist bias is operative, where they tend to be pretty dismissive of music, a lot like what you really enjoy, that it's too popular, you know, too popular. It's not hard enough to listen to. It's not difficult enough.
Let me say something. That there's a difference between record reviewers and jazz critics. Frequently, they're the same thing. But there are other people. There are people like Gary Giddens, Martin Williams, you know, who are really essayists.
Right.
And they're the ones who put the eras into perspective and things like that. But record reviewers are out there, you know, dealing with a particular project at a particular time, and that's what they do.
Yeah.
But the thing that annoys me most about jazz critics is that you must remember that if you discover the next new guy, it can be a big deal for you. I mean, you look at Gary Giddens, and the one musician he promoted through the years was David Murray. Now, Stanley Crouch, the one musician that Stanley Crouch promoted through the years, was Wynton Marsalis. Now, let's compare the careers of the two, if you will. You know, I mean, Wynton Marsalis is a household name.
Yeah.
And Stanley Crouch, you know, made a hell of a lot of money because of his association with Wynton.
Yeah.
As far as I know, David Murray is still out there, but he's still scuffling, and nobody knows who the hell he is. For the most part, I guess he works mostly in Europe. So, you know, to a certain extent, can you say Giddens backed the wrong horse? Well, maybe. But he certainly didn't have the mind of the public in mind when he chose to promote David Murray.
Yeah.
Now, you can say to yourself, well, jazz people are not supposed to care about what the public thinks. They're supposed to use their own knowledge, their own instincts, their own ears to determine what's good and what isn't good. But, I mean, look, acknowledging the eternal verities of jazz will never get you anyplace.
Yeah.
If you find the next new thing, that can get you somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's a particularly interesting case, too, because Crouch was actually in the same band as David Murray, I guess, before they came to the East Coast.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so he actually did have a chance to put money on that pony.
Well, yeah, but Stanley's, remember this, Stanley's attitude changed considerably.
Oh, yeah.
When he started becoming chummy with Albert Murray. Albert Murray turned him around.
Yeah.
And Albert Murray is probably, between, Albert's probably the principal mentor to Wynton Marsalis once Wynton gets to New York.
Yeah. Well, he's kind of the aesthetician or something, right?
Well, no. I mean, Murray was, you know, he wasn't the most successful writer in the world, although God knows he published some wonderful books. But he had a way of crystallizing the question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's good jazz? Well, it's jazz that swings, it has blues feeling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He could do that where other guys would get hung up in the periphery, you know, and not understand that, you know, it's not all that difficult.
Yeah.
If it's going to be good, it has to have certain qualities. And I don't much care for a lot of, you know, modern jazz criticism. There's certain guys that I read and I like. I like Mark Myers, who writes in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, I look at his blog sometime, too.
Yeah, yeah. I read his blog probably every day. But there are not a lot of people who come along and impress me, although I like Ricky Riccardi and what Ricky has done on behalf of Louis Armstrong. That's also good. That ought to be mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's where it's going to be from now on. You're going to find more people like Ricky who hone in on a particular subject and become the authority. I don't think that's bad at all.
Right.
And guys like that are really kind of historians on individual subjects.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, the history gets old. It gets, at a certain point, it gets where it's incomprehensible to a single person, right? Whereas when you first came along, I'm 10 years younger than you. That's half the history of, you know, recording from about 18.
Well, I'll give you an example. Now this, you know, you can take credit or not take credit for certain stuff. When you have your name on an album as a producer or something like that, you have to take you take the credit and you take the knocks too. And I'm not saying my records were perfect, so I don't think, despite the fact that I produced about 175 albums, I think I do at least as much for music history by the discographies I worked on.
Mm-hmm.
The first major label discography about a label was the Prestige thing that I did with Michelle Rupley way back in the 60s. Rupley wrote me a letter. He came to New York. He went through all the Prestige files, and we compiled the discography of the whole label. And nobody had done that before that time.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, Rupley develops into a cottage industry, and he does one on Blue Note, and he does one on Atlantic, and he does one on this label and that label, and he came up with a whole stuff. You know, I mean, that's very important because the history of a record label is not the kind of thing that anybody was promoting in those particular years. But, you know, the people who work for a label, the people who make decisions, I mean, that's very important stuff.
Yeah.
Because in large measure, they're the people who determine who gets recorded.
When you went freelance in the mid-70s, you then were in a position, were you not, where you in particular with reissues, you could come up with a project on your own, but you'd have to go pitch it to somebody or find somebody who wanted to finance it. Is that how it worked?
Reissue projects were generally in-house projects.
Uh-huh.
In other words, it was usually the task of somebody who worked for the label as opposed to a freelancer. Sometimes the guy who worked for the label, whose project it is, would hire a freelancer to do a particular project for the label. That tended to be how it worked in those days. You know, you could do stuff for Columbia, but you had to go through a Jim Fishel or you had to go through somebody else. You could do stuff for RCA, but it had to be through somebody else. You know, it's like that. And, you know, you can understand the label's paying somebody to, you know, do their in-house A&R stuff, and they should be doing their reissues.
Yeah.
So the most reissues I got done was when I was actually on staff at Savoy and on staff at Atlantic. In many respects, when you're on staff, you can get a hell of a lot more done than if you're a freelancer. I always describe it thusly. If you're on staff, you can walk right into a guy's office. If you're a freelancer, you need a pass just to get upstairs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So access was something you would have if you were on staff that freelancers could never really get to.
Yeah. In some ways, if you're on staff, it works a good bit like, I mean, people are fond of comparing producers and music to directors in cinema, but if you're on staff, it very often works precisely like the producer would work, the line producers would work at a big studio like MGM during the classic era. They have a budget, they're keeping an eye on, you know, they may be doing, in addition to the job of producer, they may be doing the job of a director, but they nonetheless, they're having to watch a number of different things rather than just who shows up on a particular day. Accurate?
When I worked for Atlantic, every project had a budget. They were very careful about budgets, and they wanted to know where every dime was being spent. On Savoy, my job was really just to get a certain number of LPs out. Not necessarily monthly, but every other month.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you knew how much you would pay for liner notes. The art department at Arista were the people who did the covers for the most part. And while every once in a while I could have some input, I didn't know what their budgets were. But somebody did. Somebody at Arista knew what the budgets were. And, you know, that's how that went. I mean, I was a little, probably Steve Backer would have been knowing what the budgets were, but we never went over budgets on stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we did the best job we could within what we had, you know.
Yeah.
Atlantic was a different problem. The Chiquette album went way over budget because, you know, I pulled some shit on me at the last minute.
Uh-huh.
Rascal. But it wasn't that much over budget, but it was probably 25% over budget.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure Atlantic has never broken even on that record.
Yeah.
But, you know, they, once again, Ahmet didn't go into making that album with the theory of selling a lot of records. He went in to document a musician he was impressed with.
Yeah.
He did that with a lot of different people. He did it with blues artists, too. He did it with Rockin' Doopsie, the Zydeco band. He did it with Jimmy Rogers. You know, he didn't do it all that frequently. But, you know, when he set his mind to doing it, he would do it. He's, as I say, he's the only guy I've ever seen who was able to do that.
Well, I really appreciate you talking to me. You've been a very interesting. I've really enjoyed it, and I appreciate it so much.
It's easier for me, Mike, if you have follow up to do it by email.
I'll do that then.
You know, and I can deal with stuff as it goes. If there's any artists that you want to know about, you know, working with them on Prestige or on a freelance basis, you know.
Okay.
Most people who talk to me forget about the Milestone stuff I did with Hank Crawford and Jimmy McGriff and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
That stuff was actually, you know, some of those records were hits, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, among those I was listening to, your Hank Crawford After Dark, actually.
Yeah. Hank was a sweet guy.
Yeah.
And certainly a unique soloist for his era.
Yeah. Yeah. So melodic.
Yeah, I mean, he was not, you know, he grew up with the George Colemans and the Harold Mayburns and Booker Littles and all those guys in Memphis. You know, he came up with all those guys. But he didn't play like any of them. He could play bebop.
Yeah.
He liked to do it from time to time, but that isn't what he was known for.
Yeah. Yeah, I talked once to Sid Feller about the role that Hank Crawford played with Ray Charles, where Hank Crawford, you know, would often just sit and transcribe all that stuff that Ray Charles
I'll tell you a story that'll be of interest to you. For many years, I used to be one of the MCs of the Chicago Blues Festival, which took place in the month of June. It was a free festival outdoors in Grant Park in Chicago. Huge festival. I mean, having over 100,000 people in attendance on a given day was not unusual. So the guy calls me and says, look, we're going to do a Ray Charles. This is 1998. And he says, but instead of bringing his band in, we're going to do a reunion with the original horn section. So they found Marcus Belgrave and Philip Gilbo and, of course, Hank and Fathead and Leroy Cooper. You know, those were the five most prominent horns. There were some guys who were in and out of that band, you know, but that was basically the instrumentation and everything. And Ray said, you know, the funny thing is, I love the idea, but I can't find the arrangements. Well, Hank Crawford had all the arrangements.
Mm.
He kept all the arrangements for that small band, and he kept them in a specific place in case they would be needed someday. And boy, they were needed that day. And Hank took them out of the trunk and brought them to Chicago. Oh, what a great day that was. Oh,
wow.
They really sounded wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. That's tremendous. Yeah. Well, again, thank you a million.
All right, Mike, what's actually the project you're working on?
Oh, the project I'm working on, I think I mentioned to you, I just had a book published by Wesleyan University Press called Producing Country.
Okay.
And I talked to lots and lots of country producers. And actually, at the time, I pitched that book to them, and that book was more investigative journalism. I think you can tell that I've been a jazz fan for a while.
Sure.
But so that book was investigative journalism, and I love country. But it was some sleuthing involved for me, at least. So they came out with that book. But at the same time I pitched that book, I pitched one on producing jazz. And they had just done, they said, too many books on jazz recently. and so they weren't interested in that project at that time. So that book, the country book out, I've decided to return to the jazz book, and it'll be, you know, this week is flying under the banner of a title of something like Recording Jazz or the Jazz Record, and I'm interested in talking about what great producers have done, projects they've worked on, you know, and good narratives.
Have you been able to reach everybody you wanted to talk to?
I have. I'm working on Rudy Van Gelder right now.
Well, you better hurry.
And actually, Maureen Sickler is supposed to be talking to him maybe as we speak. He wasn't feeling good yesterday, but I sent him a couple of questions.
You know, Rudy will be 90 in November, and he's not in great health.
Yeah.
I mean, the studio is still open, and he's still doing sessions, but, you know. But going through Maureen Sickler is absolutely the right thing to do with it.
Yeah, yeah, so that's what I've done there.
You know, she should be a saint for what she's done with him.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think I'm close to running out of people that I feel that I really, really need to talk to. The guy I need to talk to, I wrote him a letter last night, is Manfred Eicher at ECM. So that's a chapter that doesn't, you know, get talked about that much with American.
Well, I mean, I can help you with some of the guys who are gone. You know, Esmond Edwards was a mentor to me.
Yeah, I actually talked to him, but I'd love to hear anything you have to say about him. But I had a great conversation with him before he passed. I talked to Weinstock.
So you got him. Well, I could help you with Teddy Reig. I could help you with Bob Shadd.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, I actually worked for Shadd for a little while. Not long, but worked with him.
Well, if you've got a minute,
Teddy,
then tell me about Teddy.
Huh?
If you've got a minute, tell me about Teddy Reig, then.
Well, Teddy Reig was loud, opinionated, boisterous, and he weighed almost 400 pounds at his peak. His big thing, the thing that he probably should be remembered and will be remembered for more than anything else, is the great series of Count Basie records on Roulette. Signing Basie to Roulette was his thing. He produced all those Basie records, and for my money, it's the greatest era of Basie recording, at least by the New Testament band, you know.
Yeah.
The Old Testament band, that's John Hammond's territory. He did the best records.
Those Neil Hefti charts and so on at the New Testament.
I mean, look, that first album. If you go to hear the Count Basie Orchestra today, and that band is still working, and there are still guys who are in the Basie band who are in that band, you will hear probably 80% of that first album.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the E equals MC squared, they call it the Atomic Mr. Basie.
Yeah.
Sensational record, one of the great jazz records of all time.
It is, yeah.
And, you know, that, as I say, that music is still being played everywhere. But Teddy did a lot of stuff for Savoy. He found guys. He made the first Charlie Parker records. He made the first Dexter Gordon records. He made the first Stan Getz records. He made the, you know, I mean, you can go on and on and on and on like that. And you could say, well, some of these guys didn't make a lot of records for Savoy. Well, that was because of Lubinsky and how cheap he was.
Yeah.
Teddy really knew how to make records, and his track record for that kind of stuff is terrific.
Well, those Stan Getz at the Roost, that was a great.
Oh yeah, I
group.
Mean Roost was his label before Roulette.
Uh huh.
And ultimately, Roost got sold to Roulette.
Uh huh.
But Teddy was a character by all means. Did you ever read Ed Berger's book on him?
No, I did not.
Oh well, if you're interested in jazz record producers, I think it's Scarecrow Press.
Okay. Yeah.
Highly recommended. Very entertaining.
Okay, yeah. And
Esmond, as I say, Esmond was a real mentor to me. I mean, I, you know, paid a lot of attention to him. First record date I ever went to was one of his sessions. And, you know, I mean, here I was a 22-year-old college kid, and he was treating me like an equal. you know. And I think it was largely because I was probably the only white guy who ever asked him about Gene Ammons.
Okay. Yeah. That label, I think I said this to Bob Weinstock, you know, it was just chock full with junkies. But jazz was too at that time as well.
Well, at one time, yes.
But I've often thought, and I'm curious what your take on it would be, I've often thought that the manner in which Weinstock produced them, where there weren't rehearsals and so on, they could show up, and he had unbelievable, you know, take the case of Coleman Hawkins or someone who could, you know, run something down one time and have it. It was hospitable to certain kinds of players that maybe other labels weren't. But in your own case, was it ever a problem with Gene Ammons to just work with people who could be unreliable?
Well, by the time I got to Gene, it was 1969, and he was out of prison.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't strung out at all during the last part of his life.
Oh, okay.
You know, once he got Esmond is the one who had to put up with a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Oh God, some of the I can't tell you some of the stories.
I believe it. Yeah.
They're just things that you don't want people to know about.
Well, I bet people reminded you how lucky you were.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I feel blessed that I was able to work and even to know some of these guys.
Sure, you know? Yeah, yeah.
There's very few of them left. I was just told today that they want me at the Detroit Jazz Festival over Labor Day weekend to do an interview with Lou Donaldson.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So I said, great. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
I've
known Sweet Lou for a long time. In fact, I gave him that name, Sweet Lou.
Okay. How about the Mighty Burner? Was that already in place?
Well, Mighty Burner was the name of a tune.
Yeah, but
tune, The Mighty Burner, was actually named for Sonny Hobson.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
Broke the record.
Yeah.
And in time it became Charlie's nickname.
Yeah.
It became The Burner.
Right, right, yeah. I'd forgotten that was Sonny Hobson's tag, yeah. Yeah, I'm just 2 miles or 2 hours away from Philadelphia where I sit here in York, Pennsylvania. Yeah. Well, again, thank you a million.
Look, Mike, it's a good project. If I can help you in any way, shoot me an email and I'll get right back.
I'll call out to you sometime maybe to take a look at the manuscript or something like that. Give me a pick your brain again. Thank
sure.
you, Bob.
Okay, take
okay.
care.
Okay, bye.